It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
On this episode of First Lady and Friends, I had a great conversation with Katie Donneville, Executive Director at English Skills Learning Center. I had the opportunity to visit this organization and do some teaching myself. It was really fun to reconnect with her and learn about her students and where they are now and what they're doing and the amazing things that are happening there. Can't wait for you to take a listen. Let's get proximate. We are back here on First Lady and Friends. So excited for you to meet this amazing guest. It's somebody that I've just met recently, and we had a great conversation. Her name is Katie Donneville, the executive director at English Skills Learning Center. We did a tour of your place and your organization, and it was amazing. So I want to get into that. But first, let's talk about you, Katie. Let's talk about your background. Just tell us a little bit about you, like where you grew up and stuff, and a little bit about your family.
So I'm from Arizona, and I grew up in a small rural area in the mountains of Arizona.
Where at?
I feel like I spend half my life explaining.
I know.
Like, I didn't grow up in the desert. I grew up in the mountains of Arizona. So the closest town that people may be familiar with is Sholo.
Yes.
So we grew up outside of that in Linden.
Okay.
So
I have a sister that lives in, you may not know, I don't know, Concho. Do you know where Concho
is?
Yes,
I do. Yeah.
I have a sister that lives in Concho.
Same area, yeah. Like White Mountains of Arizona.
Very cool.
Yeah, similar. Yeah. Nice. So I grew up there. Went through high school there. I'm a first generation college student. And in high school, my saving grace, somebody at the high school kind of noticed a path I was on and said, hey, I don't think you're being challenged enough. Maybe you should check out this program that was, it paid for community college classes during high school. Mm. And I wasn't sure if college was going to be an option for me. And I was like, well, somebody believes in me and thinks that I can do this. And I leaned into that pretty heavily. And I actually got my associate's degree during high school.
Wow.
And then went on to get my bachelor's degree, and then later my master's at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then I spent some time teaching at NAU as well. It just kind of became my home. Flagstaff for a long time is where I met my husband. He was born in Ogden, and I kind of kept him in Arizona, I think, longer than he anticipated. And then, after we were married and living in Arizona for a while, he said, you know, I really want to get back to Utah, where my family's from. And so here we are. We've been here for 7 years now and both on solid career paths here. We have two children and just loving every minute of life lately. It seems like everything's just going really well. And it's great to be in that space.
Oh, I love it. I love it. What did you study when you were there in Arizona? How did your journey get you here career-wise?
Yeah, so we kind of laugh about my story and my family because I came home from the first day of kindergarten and said, I'm going to be a teacher. And it was kind of like, oh, okay, yeah, sure. And then I, you know, kept coming home from school saying, I'm going to be a teacher. And it just kind of stuck. So I've joked that I've wanted to be a teacher my whole life. I studied in seventh grade, the I want to be a teacher became I want to be a seventh grade teacher. And then in eighth grade, it was still I want to be a seventh grade teacher. Oh. And a lot of people, you know, think I'm a little off my rocker for wanting to teach junior high at that time.
Well, I was going to say, there's a special place in heaven for middle school teachers, I will say.
I think there was just something about my experience at that time, too, that I'm really fascinated personally about neurodevelopment and psychology and how people work, right? I'm so interested in people. And I think that was such a time when people are, you know, these young kids are developing in ways that they don't quite understand and their brains literally can't process decisions that they're trying to make, and there's so much social pressure. And I had so many teachers at that time that were really supportive, and that just kind of stuck with me. So when I studied my bachelor's, I studied secondary language arts. So reading, writing, but not necessarily language learners, just more of the language arts side of things. And I was in my student teaching placement at a high school, and the teacher I was placed with at the time, she introduced me to the class and kind of said, these people in the front are going to work really hard and they're engaged, and all those people in the back, don't worry about it. And I said,
wow.
What? And that was heartbreaking for multiple reasons, but especially as a new teacher, it was just like I wasn't going to stand for that. So, of course, me being me, I really got to know the students in the back and trying to figure out, you know, what was going on there. And I quickly learned that all of them had just graduated the previous year out of the Sheltered English Immersion program. Okay. So this was their first time in a mainstream English speaking class. And that just kind of ignited this, like, English learners are not being served well in schools, and I got to figure out what to do about this. And so I taught for a little while and then went right back into my master's, essentially, in teaching English as a second language to learn everything I possibly could about how people learn languages and how we can reach people effectively. And then from there, it was just kind of one thing led to another. I started working at the university as a teaching assistant to, you know, work my way through my program, and started teaching rhetoric and composition, both to people who had matriculated into the university, but also people who were in the intensive English language program at the college. So I was kind of the last course before people matriculated, their first credit-bearing course, giving them an insight into academic writing and all that comes along with that. And then I made this drastic shift when we moved to Utah. We knew we were making this move, and we knew it was the right decision for us and starting our family and where we wanted to be, but I had no idea what I was going to do for my career. And so I started searching, you know, about all the universities in Utah, started looking at high schools and junior highs again, and then said, you know what, I think I need to be involved in something more grassroots, community-based. Like, I wanted something in adult education. And then I came across the English Skills Learning Center kind of on a whim, knew nothing about the organization, and applied for a program coordinator position. And that's how I started at the organization. Mm-hmm. And we kind of laugh about it now because we live in West Haven, and the ESLC is situated in Salt Lake County. And when I first started at the organization, I said, I'll start doing this, and then I'll find something closer to home. And 7 years later,
<You're still
laughs> here I am in the executive director position. No plans of leaving this work anytime soon because I just love everything that we're doing and how it's evolved. And it's just one thing's led to another, and here we are.
Yeah. And great doors that have opened because, I mean, you're doing incredible work. We had you and I met because, with our show up team, specifically our service organization, our service committee, we've been going around doing visits with different nonprofits around the state, really trying to understand the volunteer space, the nonprofit space. And for us, it's really trying to connect. You know, we don't want to reinvent anything. We want to just elevate, you know, the incredible work. There's so many great, just phenomenal nonprofits in the state that are doing critical work for our communities. And so for us, it's really kind of understanding that ecosystem, kind of understanding that, you know, the players and the people that are doing this work, and how do we connect them and how do we uplift them. And so it's been really fun. So we came and visited. And we got some hands-on experience, which was really, really fun. So maybe talk a little bit about the English Skills Learning Center. Maybe talk a little bit about, you know, your program and what you have available there, and maybe a little bit of who you serve.
Yeah. I definitely I'm so passionate about what we do that sometimes I can just go on and get into these technical terms. And so I really started telling people about our organization by introducing them to three people. So I'm going to introduce you to three people. So Goy Makonnen, she is a refugee from Eritrea. She in Eritrea had less than 5 years of schooling, and she's now working at a Desert Industries location that we partner with. And a part of their employment is that they're in English classes with us. So 12 hours of the week is English class, and the rest of her job is, you know, on the floor gaining work training skills, typical of DI programs elsewhere. So this program is specifically for people who have never learned to read or write in any language. So very unique student population. They're not coming with maybe knowledge of how formal classrooms operate. They don't have literacy skills in their primary language to pull on. So they're learning a second language, literacy, kind of expectations of a classroom all at once. Goy, in the program, within 2 years, she made 3 level gains on our speaking assessment and 2 level gains on our reading assessment. And to give you some kind of idea about this progress, the research is showing like 500 to 1,000 hours of instructional time to make 1 level gain for this population. So she's surpassing that greatly with her gains. And so this is the first person I want to introduce you to, Goy. So second person is Tony Myers. And Tony has been volunteering with us for 5 years. She comes with a background of, you know, database knowledge and creation and working in different spaces within the more like back end side of adult education. And she watched this documentary called Rain in a Dry Land. Highly recommend it. And she just was so inspired to work with refugee and immigrant populations. And so she came to us and basically said, how can I help? Like full open book. Like, here's my background. Here's my experience. What can I do to help? And she's since then been, you know, leading classroom instruction. She's does data entry, things around the office, works with us in a number of ways. For the past 5 years, she's been engaged with us. And the next person I want to introduce you to is Tivu Mims. And I'll start by saying T was taken from this world way too soon. But during her time on Earth, she was committed to lifting up historically marginalized voices. She's a daughter of Vietnamese refugees, and she wants to really connect people in a way that she did through her professional life at SLIC and in her personal life starting a bakery, Mims Bakery. But she was engaged with us as a board member and a volunteer in our classroom. She was starting that process to volunteer in our classrooms and just really speaks to the spirit of what it means to be an engaged community member and and trying to make a difference. Like, that was her in everything that she did, from her professional life to raising her own kids as well. And so I introduced you to these three people. What these people have in common, they've all received awards from the ESLC. So Goy was our Learner of the Year last year. Tony was our Jean and Bruce Bingham Literacy Legacy Award winner. And we honored her with the First Community Voices Award. All of them came to us with this willingness to learn and engage and with the understanding that every single one of them played a part in successful integration. And that is maybe what makes the ESLC a little bit different in the way that we approach things is one technical term that I will use and I do want to spread and teach about is two-way mutual integration. So this idea that if one new person comes into the community is different now. It's a new community. Yeah. And every single person in that community is now responsible for making that community stronger and greater and whole again. So this is how we approach everything that we do at the ESLC, is how do all community members participate in successful integration and what does that look like? So for English-speaking community members, they can come to us and learn skills of being a classroom volunteer, or they can attend these trainings that we do. Sometimes we hold trainings about modifying your speech when you're talking to somebody who's learning English to make it a little bit easier. So English speakers can carry some of that burden, not burden even, just some of the weight of, you know, how much pressure is on language learners to get it right. We can do things to adjust our language when speaking to people. So we hold these trainings like this. And then we also have a book club, which is called the Speakeasy. And this is a kind of a play on words here. Speakeasies historically have been, you know, a place that people can go and be free and, like, you know, let loose a little bit. And this is kind of what we wanted to do with the Speakeasy, was that it can be a place to speak easily about really complex topics. And people can come read. We do a book a month, and the book is usually a memoir about a refugee or immigrant experience. And people can come and ask the difficult questions, right? Or just the curious questions. And then we, as the staff and maybe other community members who attend the book club, can challenge and educate some of the ideas that are brought up based off of the experiences that we know our student population has. One of the reasons that we do it this way is because community members with the best intentions will often ask refugees and immigrants about their experiences, and without realizing that they may be re-traumatizing or creating this power dynamic within the community that is not healthy. So we've created this space to kind of alleviate some of that pressure, and people can still ask questions, but we're playing our part in avoiding re-traumatization. And then for English language learners, we have a variety of different programs that are kind of rooted in foundational literacy, citizenship preparation, family literacy, and workplace training. So all of our programs are content-based, so they're learning English alongside with some skill, hence English Skills Learning Center. So a lot of people say, like, oh, you do ESL, and we joke because the name of our organization was very intentionally created because ESL is outdated. It's an outdated term. Most of our students are fluent in like 7-8 languages. This isn't their second language when they're coming to us. And so it's kind of a play on words of it's English skills. So everything that we're learning is tied to some specific skill. We do our best to really make it relevant, as adult education should be, along with age appropriate and trauma informed. So if people are learning about transportation, they're not just learning like basic vocabulary about transportation. They're learning like what UTA is and what the terms are that they would need to successfully navigate that on their own. So it's really tied to community need. And that's kind of how the ESLC has evolved throughout its inception. We started as a literacy organization in 1988 for anybody who needed literacy skills. And as demographics of Salt Lake changed, we changed to focus on English language learners. And we've just been adapting and evolving to community need and requests since then.
Oh, that's amazing. It's such an incredible mission, and you guys are doing it so well. I want to keep talking about this and your student population. I want to have you share maybe some more stories, especially as we get into it. We had such a great experience there, too. So we'll do that when we come right back.
I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
We're back here with Katie Donneville. She's the executive director of English Skills Learning Center. And we had such a great time when we went to visit you because, you know, sometimes we go on these these visits, and they're great, and so much information, which we got there as well. But like, we actually had a hands-on experience, and you know, being from a teaching background myself, and actually being from early childhood, and you know, people with disabilities, it actually was so interesting to me because it felt really great to be back in a classroom. Of course, the students that were there are, you know, again, are very different. These are adults learning to read. Sometimes, in the like you said, this is the first language they're learning how to read. I thought it was really interesting. We had such a great experience working with folks that you know, the particular activity we were doing was learning how to read a clock. Which is really interesting because it's one of those things I think, well, maybe I need to go back and teach my kids because my kids still don't. I think in schools they were like, okay, that's a nice skill, but I don't have to use it, right? Yeah. Like, so this is an interesting skill. But they were so delightful, absolutely delightful. These folks were so genuinely humble and eager to learn and trying so hard. And after I left, I remember thinking, my goodness, they are brave and they are strong and they are smart. Because I think about me trying to learn to read and all these other skills, not just reading, but all these other, you know, really, like you said, really important skills and life skills at my age. Like, I can't even memorize anything anymore. I can't imagine learning this skill for the first time at, you know, and some of them were older than me. Some of them were, you know, well into their older ages. And I just came away with a new appreciation for the struggle and for the hard work and for the trauma that they've been through that brought them to this place at this moment. I always say this about refugees and the immigrant population. Nobody wanted to leave. They didn't want to leave their country. They didn't want to leave their homes. They didn't want, nobody wants to do that. Yeah. It wasn't, you know, like a deliberate choice. Like I am trying to, you know, no, they didn't have the privilege of deciding they wanted, like you know, yeah. I want to relocate to Utah. Right. I mean, that's not what this is.
Imagine the situation that lets you look at your family and your life and where you were born and your home country and make the choice to leave.
Yeah.
That's big.
That's
not a choice taken lightly. And yeah, it's not a choice at all.
Right. Because most of the time, especially if you're a refugee, you have been
resettlement, right?
Yeah. You have been forced out either because of war or because of, you know, persecution in some way, usually after tremendous trauma. Mm-hmm. I mean, trauma that I can't even fathom. You know, when I've listened to people's stories, it's a kind of heartbreak that it's really hard to even process. And so, anyway, I loved their spirit. They were just, all of them were just really, really incredible. So maybe talk a little bit about your population. What are you seeing? How does that trauma affect their ability to learn? How does their strength help them? You know, what are some things that you're seeing from them?
Yeah, I know we do tend to focus on like, oh gosh, people have had such hard lives and they've been through so much and there's so much trauma involved. And yes, that is all true. But there's also these like great strengths that come with that. And resilience is often a word that I use to describe the refugee population. Specifically is just resilient, like the most resourceful people to be able to up and leave with nothing and navigate that whole system and go through, you know, if you're familiar with the long process of that it comes to go through refugee resettlement and start over. Resilient is the word, right?
Yep.
And some of the students that you were working with, so you were also in a class of adult emergent readers, so people learning to read and write for the first time. I'll tell you, we took a short break of classes during June, and so they just started back up now in July. And one of our program coordinators was just saying that she met with a student, and she immediately said, "I studied." And she mm-hmm. said all of the vocab words that they had been learning before they left in June. The program coordinator was like, "What?" There's not a notebook somewhere that these are written down because the person doesn't have literacy. So really how you're saying, like, I can't even remember what I had for breakfast, right? The skills that come from people from, you know, oral storytelling backgrounds, it's just different than what we're used to. We're such a literacy-based society. So sometimes it's just great to see, like, you have a skill set that I don't have, probably never will for certain reasons. And so we definitely approach that in the classroom with this, you know, strength-based approach of what skills do our students have and how can we, you know, use that in our classroom instruction. And the same with trauma. You know, I mentioned earlier that I'm really interested in neuroscience, and it's just something that always fascinates me. And there is a real, there are structural chemical things that happen in your brain when it comes to trauma and storing memory and storing new information and being able to learn. And so something that we strive for at the SLC is creating instruction that follows what we call the teacher type is a warm demander. So somebody who can build relationships and have a strong rapport with their students, but also has high expectations in the classroom. And this concept, you know, I first heard this concept come from this book, Culturally Responsive Teaching in the Brain by Zaretta Hammond. It's amazing. Any educators out there, just buy it and read it. Changed my whole approach on how we're doing this at the SLC. It was kind of, you know, came from that book. Mm. So we do these workshops as well for other educators to know how to be trauma-informed in your classrooms. Things even like for listeners, we're sitting here right now and we're not across the table, but we're kind of next to each other. Mm-hmm. If you sit across from the table from somebody, there's this power dynamic that's created. And in a lot of cases, it can kind of represent or remind people of like being in an interrogation room mm-hmm. or, you know, even we're sitting here looking at the doorway and I can clearly see an exit, which makes me feel safe. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I were sitting maybe facing this way and couldn't see the exit or who's coming in or out, that might make me, if I have a trauma background, make me feel a little bit uncomfortable. So there are like these tiny things that you can do in a classroom space that, you know, we want to make sure we're kind of facing students towards the, like they can see an exit and they know where it's at. And anything from those tiny things that just start straight from the beginning that you might not think about all the way to, you know, the type of content we're discussing in the classroom and then how to respond to somebody who is in crisis and has mm-hmm. been triggered and how to navigate that in a classroom. So we teach all those skills in our trainings and to our staff and volunteers. Everybody's equipped with that knowledge just so we can create this safe space. And I think one of the important things and misconceptions about working with people who've experienced trauma too is, and I hear this a lot, just that, you know, you have to avoid triggering somebody, and we have to just totally sidestep anything that could be a potential trigger. And that is taking so much agency away from people, and trying to avoid topics it's not possible for mm-hmm. you to know what somebody's trigger is. And oftentimes people don't even know what their own triggers are mm-hmm. until they happen. So we always just talk about, you know, how we can be smart about things that are obvious triggers, right? If there's vocabulary word in our health literacy class about a bruise, we're not going to make that bruise on a picture of a woman's face or on somebody's arm. It's going to be in a scene where somebody's in a park and they're on the ground holding their leg and there's a bruise on their leg. So you can see exactly how this happened.
The situation,
So it's not, you know, we can still talk about the topics and we can be smart about what we introduce and how we introduce it, but we don't want to avoid anything because we are working with adults who are resilient and we just want to be able to know how to navigate those situations if they do arise. Mm.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And, you know, you think about that and really creating, I love the idea of creating an environment that that's conducive to their learning. You know, growing up, going into my, early childhood field that I did, we talk a lot about setting up that classroom environment so that it's the environment itself can be a place of learning and is conducive to learning. So I love that concept. I love that you're doing that there. I want to talk a little bit more about, the successes that you're seeing and maybe what, where your students are now and some of the paths that they've taken. And we'll do that when we come right back. We're back here with Katie Donneville, the executive director at English Skills Learning Center. That's why I wanted to have you on here because we had such a great experience. And, I just think when we connect as humans, it's always a beautiful moment. And anytime I get to know somebody that has a different story than me is when I grow, is when I learn, it's when I can appreciate the humanity that I see around me. And so I just love that experience. So I really appreciate you letting us come and participate in the process and help them, let them help me to understand, and learn from them. I want to talk about successes. Let's talk about, where are some of your students now? Let's do a where are they now thing and talk about maybe some of those success stories.
Yeah, it's so funny because language learning is such a long journey sometimes. And at the ESLC, we focus on, very beginning students all the way up to lower intermediate. So sometimes when students, quote unquote, graduate our programs, they're not done yet. There's still a long way to go, and that might be a referral to another adult education setting or something else, career path. And so sometimes we don't see the full extent of the process until years later. We have these little successes every day, of course, in class and things that are happening that are really great. Actually, I just had one of these experiences probably 2 months ago. I went to end of the year celebration at the Glendale Mountain View Community Learning Center, we've held classes there historically, great partner. And one of the attendees at the event was a student of mine from 5 years ago. And so we both just kind of looked at each other like, oh, yeah, hi, how are you? Let's catch up and see where you're at. And she always told me in class, she wanted to learn English and she really loved gardening, but she knew that that is not a career. And I always tell everyone, get curious is my thing all the time. Get curious about that. So maybe not in those words that I used with her, but anything's possible. So catching up with her, we had this whole conversation in English about where she is now. I was actually pregnant with my oldest daughter at the time that I was teaching her class. So I guess it's been 4 years now. We had this whole conversation in English, catching up about everything. And then she just told me that she started a program for elementary school students to learn about gardening.
Really?
Vegetables and flowers and life cycle of plants. It's like an after-school program at some of the Title I schools. And she's running it. And that's what she does for her full-time work now.
Oh, my word.
It was just one of those moments that is like, you did it.
Yeah.
You created what you thought wasn't even possible. And that's we talk about this concept of the American dream, and that can mean many things to different people. But I think part of what that means is anything is open to you. Like the possibilities are there. While there might be barriers that exist and other things, the idea that the possibility is there, she really leaned into that, and it was just fun to see that success after so many years. It's kind of circle back.
Oh, I love that. I think it's always, that's kind of that payday.
Yeah.
When you think I'm working so hard. I mean, you see it with your own kids. I see it with my kids. It's just day in and day out working, and you're like, and coming from a special education background, you know, sometimes those successes or you're not seeing the progress always until maybe all of a sudden you do, you know, mm-hmm. and something happens or you've spent, you know, a lot of time or they've spent their, you know, they're working their guts out and they finally have that breakthrough moment. So I love to see that. Maybe as we end, let's just talk about, you know, what has surprised you in this work? What's something unexpected that you've experienced?
I love this question. I feel like I'm surprised all the time, yeah. in a number of ways, but I think maybe I had a very narrow view of teacher training and volunteers when I started mm-hmm. at the ASLC, which I know if like my team's listening to this right now, they're going to gasp at me even talking about this. But I think I definitely came in when I first started working at the ASLC and, you know, it was we use volunteers to teach our classrooms. I had this like, like I have a master's degree.
Yeah,
teaching English
there's
as a
some
second
skills.
Language, there's so many skills and there's, you know, this training process and I think I doubted the effectiveness that volunteers could have in the classroom. Mm. And like that has been surprising on multiple levels because now I'm not even, don't even question using volunteers in classrooms, but I actually advocate like in spaces we have some partners who are asking like, oh, paid instructors only. And I'm like, maybe volunteers as classroom assistants. Like there's a true purpose to having volunteers in the classroom for everyone. Like the volunteers learn something, the students learn something, but I think something about people who are trained in teaching English as a second language or even speech pathology, right? Like you get an ear for things. And so if I'm talking to somebody who has a specific language background, like I know the sounds that are similar and so the sounds that they might mix up or the way that they're producing language and how that connects to their primary language. And volunteers might not know that. And so there becomes this true, we call it productive struggle and negotiation of meaning that happens where like both volunteers and language learners have to advocate for themselves and navigate these real world situations. Like I always say the bus driver, and I don't know why I pick on the bus driver. Sorry to all the bus drivers out there. But I always say, like, the bus driver might not be able to understand you as well as I can. And so the goal is, like, how can you communicate with the bus driver?
Yeah.
And that might require students to say, like, I don't understand you. Or please say that again slowly. Or learn these self-advocacy skills. And the same thing with volunteers to say, like, I don't understand you, and maybe that's my fault and not your fault, and admit that there's, you know, a two-way process there. So I think the most surprising thing to me, you know, I made a conscious choice to switch to community-based work, and it's just continued to surprise me in the ways that it truly is community building, and we're seeing huge success in that in ways that I don't think I even realized when I made that decision. Like, I didn't even imagine the extent of what's possible when community members come together and kind of, you know, something I hear you talk about a lot is like when you get to know people, you learn and you grow. Like that whole concept surprises me every day.
I love that. That's amazing. And I think people like you are making a huge difference in the world because of your openness and your willingness to learn and do it in a better way and figure things out and listen to people that have a story to tell and have beautiful things to teach us. I appreciate what you do. And again, you're one of those great partners in the community that's making a difference. So I really appreciate that. And this has been a great time to get to know you and what you're doing. And again, we're big fans and we're big supporters of what you're doing. So keep it up and we'll do what we can to support.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you. Thank you so much for having us.
Katie and the ESLC team are having an annual picnic in the park. It's on September 8th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Fitz Park in South Salt Lake. It's a family event. It's their 35th anniversary event. The first 200 people get meals. Bring your family, but don't bring your dogs. And you can find more information at ESLCenter.org. Thanks for being a friend.
A gun in the face.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
Started 2 years of horror for an American in Venezuela.
They said, you need to give us your phone and get ready because you're coming with us.
I'm Becky Bruce, and I spent a year researching and piecing together Josh and Tammy Holt's story about their ordeal in a notorious prison.
That's when everything started to turn bad. We had another pound on the door. Boom, boom, boom. And there was the police once again.
You can binge all of the episodes of Hope in Darkness on KSLPodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.